Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 97. Oh, we're getting close to 100. I haven't told you who I've got planned for the 100th episode because it might fall through. So until I've got it recorded, I'm not going to say. Because people keep asking if I've got big plans for the 100th episode. I've got big plans for every episode, man. I love doing this and I'm proud of the content and quality that we put out every week, regardless of if you've heard of the person or not. I genuinely think we've not had a dud in a long time. Anyway, there was one that I've mentioned that I didn't feel I nailed it on. It's not a slight on the guest, but I won't go into that in detail now. But yeah, episode 97, Izzy Sooty, amazing guest, and what a wonderful woman. And incidentally, I think the best Polaroid that we've taken so far. Just throwing that out there. As a lot of you know, I'll take a golden Polaroid to label each episode. And generally, the Polaroid film's pretty rough. It makes us look bad. The Ed Skrein one the other week. Ed Skrein is a gorgeous man. He's a handsome dude. And we both look pretty ropey in that Polaroid. It's not flattering. It's not pleasant. But this Polaroid with Izzy, I think both of us are looking pretty decent. So I'm putting that up there as possibly the best looking Polaroid we've done of the podcast so far. We talk about a lot of things in this podcast. We talk about comedy, acting, drinks, hot drinks, music, cinema. Speaking of music, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my label. You can head over there and support the podcast and the label. You can buy my Edinburgh Fringe show. We talk about Edinburgh. My Edinburgh Fringe show for the digital download, it's just a fiver. £5. I mean, how many hours of podcasts have you had for free here? Then you can go and pay £5 to get a full show. So it's worth checking out. It's spoken word and there's some gags thrown in there, which I was stunned to get good reviews on. All 4- and 5-star reviews, and we sold out 19 shows in a row. Speaking of Edinburgh, damn. My label compadres Sage Francis and B Dolan are coming to the Edinburgh Fringe for their first time ever, and they're doing 20 shows all through August. So you can go and check that out now. They're teaming up with Synergy Concerts or Promotions. But yeah, I recommend you go and grab some tickets for that now, because that's going to be an amazing show. It's their first time over doing the Fringe. I believe they're doing like a combined spoken word show. It's going to be amazing. Check them out. Yeah, what else do I need to talk to you about? The live show, the Distraction Pieces live podcast, is at the Leicester Square Theatre on August 3rd. August 3rd is my birthday, and it's also the launch of my book, the Distraction Pieces podcast book, which is just hugely exciting. And I decided there isn't anyone I'd want to spend my birthday with more than you guys. As you may have heard I did a bonus podcast a few weeks ago. This podcast has become one of my favourite ways to communicate and to get things out to people, rather than a status update or type in a little tweet or whatever else. It's nice to be able to have this access to you guys and this ability to talk and then hear back from you on social media and so on and so forth. So yeah, the Distraction Pieces podcast live is going to be a podcast with you guys. So the way we're going to do it is I'm going to get up there and I'm going to get you all to form an orderly queue at the side of the stage. And rather than just pass a mic out and you ask a question and I answer and all this, you're going to come on stage, you're going to sit down with me, and we're going to have a chat. You know, you'll have a question or a topic or a view that you want to discuss or express, and we'll talk through it a bit, all within reason. Obviously, there's people to get through, but that's going to be how it works. And we're going to record that on Wednesday, August 3rd. I'm going to do my best, actually, to get that up maybe on Thursday, so get it up immediately after, so Thursday or Friday, so that week will be a double week for podcasts. So yeah, that's the plan there. Come along, get involved. I also gave details in the bonus podcast about the kind of the book tour type thing we're going to be doing up and down the country. I gave details on the documentary that's on its way. Yeah, I recommend you go and check out the bonus podcast if you didn't get a chance, because yeah, there was a lot of information on that. I also talked about Prince, who's my favourite recording artist of all time, who passed away recently. So check that out. I should get on with a podcast. I'm going to talk to you afterwards, in case I've been hyping this for a few weeks now, but there's a guest next week that I'm hugely excited for you all to hear. So I'll talk about that at the end, though. Shall I talk about it now? No, I'll talk about it at the end. This is Izzy Sooty on episode 97 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we're going, we're there. I'm joined today by Izzy Sooty. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm good.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you for welcoming me into your home.
That's fine. I've learned that you don't drink hot drinks.
Yeah, I know. It makes a lot of people uncomfortable. How uncomfortable did it make you as a host?
I used to say that I didn't trust people who didn't drink tea or coffee.
Yeah. But so I get that.
But with you, because you said you didn't drink any hot drinks, Weirdly, it makes me trust you more than if you just didn't drink tea or coffee.
Yeah, I see. I see a liquid as something that makes sense to be cold.
Yeah,
it doesn't make sense to be hot for some reason. I drink stuff to cool down, I guess.
Have you tried hot drinks?
I had tea. I had a sip of my mum's tea once when I was about 7 or 8. I don't think I've ever tried coffee, but I'm scared to try coffee since learning off QI that coffee doesn't actually give you energy. It's your addiction that makes it seem like it's giving you energy. So if you've never had coffee, your energy level is the same as it would be when you've had a coffee, if you're a coffee drinker.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
So I'm scared to have my first coffee.
In case
it brings me down and then I'll have to keep drinking coffee, even if I don't like it, essentially.
Yeah,
I'll just be tied into it, which petrifies me.
It's terrible. I mean, it's up there with crack, isn't it?
It really is. And it doesn't count as a phobia because it's not irrational. I think it's a perfectly rational fear of becoming addicted to coffee, essentially.
Yeah, maybe that's why you don't want tea either. But, I mean, tea, the reason I like tea is I think it's very comforting. And sometimes I don't even drink all of it. I just like holding.
It's very British, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to have a warm drink, to warm your hands and warm your soul, it's therapeutic in that way, I guess.
How hot would you go if there was some water out and it was a hot day and it had got to room temperature? Would you be able to drink it?
I generally top up nice little bottles of tap water in my fridge. And when I used to drink orange, I used to always drink orange squash was my drink, and I'd normally drink that from water I'd put in the fridge.
So it was already
to get
really
cold. So I hadn't really realised, but I'm really into it being very cold.
But you don't use ice.
I use ice in soft drinks, but not in water for some reason. It feels I can get my water to an appropriate a level with the right amount of preparation anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's my own fault. I'm strict with ice. I don't like it if someone would pour me a drink and then put ice in.
Okay.
Because that's not how you cool a drink.
Yeah.
You should put the ice in first so it cools over the ice. Otherwise, it's like putting an ice cube in a bath. You're just going to heat up the ice cube rather than cool the bath. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've never thought about that. But yeah, it seems like it shouldn't be an afterthought. The ice should be
in there first. And then every bit is going over the ice. So it's cooling gradually rather than you're trying to cool that individual area and then spread that over the whole drink.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like when sometimes people make you a cup of tea and it's not strong enough and they put a new tea bag in. And it's like, oh no, that's not going to...
Are you a milk first or milk afterwards? You know this is a drink-based podcast,
yes,
right?
That's generally fine. I've got all my drink material ready. I'm writing an hour on milk, so this is going to be great. If it's a teapot, I put the milk in first.
Right.
I always put too much in because I'm not used to putting it in first.
Yeah.
And I get really annoyed because it looks weak.
I saw a picture recently that a good tea... It should be the colour of He-Man's skin.
Oh, okay.
Which was great. They had a picture to illustrate it, and it was perfect. He-Man's skin is exact good tea colour. From what I know, having never drunk tea, but I've made tea, obviously, in child labour for my parents over the years.
Maybe that's why you've got this phobia of it, though. If you used to make it, you're like a slave.
Apparently I make a really good cup of tea.
Yeah.
In fact, I should have offered... Are you a cup of tea when I came in?
Well, we've got 90 minutes, so...
Perfect.
I mean, is that the colour? I suppose that...
Yeah. That's about He-Man's skin. Yeah. I mean, that looks a bit like you've rushed it a little bit, like the tea bags had to be a bit in and then on the way.
Yeah, that's true. You really are...
I know my tea, even though I don't drink it. I've prepared some questions. The first one was, how are you? Which I think we've nailed.
I feel like we have.
The next one was, what are you? Because it is, and I don't mean that in as comical a way as it sounds, but it is great because you...
you write, you act, you do stand-up, you do music, and not only music in your stand-up, you do music outside of that as well. So, yeah, how do you see yourself, or do you not? Is it a beautiful thing to not have to categorise, I guess?
Yeah, I suppose I'm quite happy that I don't... I'm quite happy to jump from thing to thing.
Mm.
And I quite like... I'll be doing some stuff, like solo stuff, and I get a bit lonely, I suppose, at times.
Yeah.
And then I'll get an acting job where I'm with other people the whole time, and that's such a nice thing to not have control over everything and to just sort of go... Oh, you'll tell me what time to be there and, you know, what to wear and everything and what
put
to say.
Put that in someone else's hands.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're part of, you're like a cog in a big machine, and it's lovely to see. I love filming for that reason. I love, like, learning about what the focus puller does and stuff like that, which I've started to do in the last couple of years, like talk to the crew more and go, what job would I do if I was on the other side of... I've decided that I'd do continuity because I'm quite sort of anal about, like, you know... I moved the cup of tea to my mouth on that line or whatever.
And have you brought that up in acting gigs? Because I've only just started acting, and there's been a few points I felt really awkward because I'm in no place to comment or qualified, but there'll be certain bits I'll be, just so you know, this was after an explosion,
yeah,
so
hard,
I did have a little bit more here. And my thinking there is, it's way easier for you to remember your own continuity than for one person to have to make note of 20 people in a scene, and particularly with a TV series where you could be jumping from episode to episode. So
yeah, I know what you mean, but I still think they're probably, on the whole, I trust them more than me.
Yeah.
Because when I look at their notes, it's like unbelievably detailed, like bits of pencil everywhere about what people are doing. I think there were definitely a few times though when you're like, oh, you know, I was wearing a mask in this scene and now I'm not, like, kind of thing. Because big things like that can go unnoticed because people are sort of focusing on the smaller stuff.
On minute details.
Yeah. But on the whole, I think that is the job that I do, but I reckon it does take a lot of training. I was thinking about the other day, I was thinking, would I make notes in shorthand and how would you do it? Because you're right, you have got to, if there's five characters in a scene, you know, you've got to watch the rehearsal and then you're thinking, and it's also when to bring something up. Like, I guess you've got to have a good relationship with the director to, sometimes they might go,
hugely, because it can feel as if you're the nagging party or the
definitely.
Someone there to say, that's not, and again, if it's a tiny thing, but it's still important. But
you've got to know that some actors who are difficult, I've seen some actors go, I know, or leave me alone. It's a hard, you're sort of constantly kind of toing and froing. But yeah, I like, really, really like doing a bit of everything. And I love writing stuff on my own. And I've done music for a long time, since I was really young. So that feels like something that will sort of always be my friend and be with me wherever I am.
It must be kind of nice to jump between all these things in that way that you can't really get that bored or sick of anyone, because working with other people, for example, it could get to a point where you're so surrounded by the same people and you kind of just want that space. And that, in a way, whereas someone else in that situation might finish an acting gig and just hide away and play computer games for a month, you can kind of go away and do something else creative, which is a great balance, right? And it seems to be why you seem to have such a regular and high output of different projects and things.
Yeah, I'm quite bad at sitting still. Like, I sometimes have to tell myself not to do anything. Like yesterday, I went to the cinema in the day on my own, and I haven't done that.
Best way to go to the cinema.
Yeah, years. I don't think. Yeah, I know, it's brilliant. I got some biltong. Have you ever had? You don't eat meat a lot, do you? But
I do eat a bit of meat. Is that like the dried?
Sounds a bit. Do you know what biltong is? Like, drink hot drink. It's like the drink.
Like it. it's really good for you, isn't it?
I think it's supposed to be quite good.
I don't think
for
I've
you,
ever
yeah.
had it, but it's really it's high in protein.
Yeah.
And it gets rid of a lot of the badness in it because you're not cooking it in oils.
Yeah,
and stuff
that's
like that.
Right. And it's like you get it in like a packet that lasts for 2 years. And it's a bit like space food.
That's it. On paper, it should be the worst thing for you in the world because it's a packet of meat.
Yeah.
That you just open and tuck into as and when.
Yeah, it's like a packet of crisps, just a packet of meat. I mean,
meat
it seems
crisps.
Wrong.
They should just call them meat crisps.
I think if they did, a lot more people would eat them.
It'd go down a treat. So,
yeah.
So what did you go and see?
Victoria.
How was it?
Oh,
is it all in one shot? Or it's all set up to be in one shot?
It is in one shot. Well, I mean, I didn't meet the director personally, but it is in one shot. I think it is, and having read sort of some stuff about it, I think they did three takes.
It's European, isn't it?
Set in Berlin.
In Berlin, right.
Oh, man, it's really, really good. And it doesn't feel gimmicky at all. The acting's spectacular, and it's like really edge of your seat.
It's weird, it seems to have snuck up out of nowhere, because I only noticed it a week ago, and it seemed to be, I think it was on one of the on-demand things. I was like, that, I looked up and it had really good reviews. It's like, I've not heard of this at all, but suddenly it seems to be here and looks
fantastic. Because it says 2015, I guess it must have come out over there.
Right, and then it's probably had some award love and is now all over the place.
Honestly, it's beautiful. It really is. It's really, it's like an action film with where you sympathise with all the characters, the bad ones and the good ones. Like but also it's like a documentary because it's so naturally acted. And I thought it was spectacular. I didn't even open the biltong. That's how gripped on. I got biltong and these honeycomb things. It was like squares of honeycomb with half of it dipped in chocolate. I ate all of those.
Did you bring these in yourself, or did you go to a fancy cinema?
I went to a fancy cinema in Brixton, my nearest cinema, and I bought them there. But brilliant. I took an apple in.
Nice.
I hope they're not listening.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
It was a small apple. I didn't eat that either.
The last time I went to a cinema in Brixton, I went to the Ritzy. Is it?
Yeah, that's where I went.
And amazing cinema. I went to see Dead Man's Shoes on its first run, which absolutely blew me away.
So that was a while ago, wasn't it?
It was a long while back, and there's a reason that's the last time I went, because two people chose to sit behind me, and one of them had been away travelling for 5 years, and that was the first time they'd met up since they'd been away, and they chose the cinema to catch up in that manner. And it was a similar one where there was hardly anyone else in there, and it was that real thing of like... It just killed me. They were just chatting away.
Was it two blokes?
It was a guy and a girl, but it wasn't a relationship type.
Okay.
A type guy and girl. And they were just having a good old catch up
I found Goa so spiritual and stuff
like
that.
It was really, it was that kind of thing, and really deep and really, and then there was this one week where we just didn't see Civilizer and all this kind of thing. It was like, to be honest, it sounded like a great trip. I'm not hating on their trip, but it wasn't the time for them to hear about it, and it will never be the time for me to hear about it, sadly.
The thing is, you'd never do that in a play.
No. Yeah, exactly. It's bizarre. And cinemas, I do find, I mention it a lot on the podcast, but I'm in love with this cinema experience. I think it's one of the few things that, it hasn't been ruined by progressions in technology.
Yeah.
Watching a film at home, even though I love films, I can't help but glimpse at my phone or look around my living room or anything else. Whereas in the cinema, it's the one place where you're just so engrossed in it. And it's,
I totally agree. I think it's got an almost magical aura around it for me, especially going on my own in the day. Because when I started off doing stand-up, and when I gave up my day job, I've always sort of been quite, I suppose, a bit of a workaholic, so I'm not that, as I said, I'm not that good at kind of going right, I'm gonna
time off.
But I'm not lazy, but sometimes it can spill over into the thing where I'm like, right, I've really got to take a break. But I think I used to do things like go to the cinema on my own in the day more when I had like less demands on me, I suppose, when I was just sort of gigging for like, I don't know, 50 quid at night. It didn't really matter if I didn't do any new material, but I used to do that so much. I used to go and go see double bills on my own, and I love going on my own because you just kind of like, you don't have to answer to anyone, you don't have an argument about what to see.
It gets weird because I got to the point where it would be at points a strain on a relationship because something had come out, and I would kind of think, I'd kind of rather see this on my, because I'm really excited about a film, where genuinely my ideal situation is sitting there on my own and watching it rather than sitting in anyone else. And that's not a slight on anyone, but it's just that beauty of the emptiness and the space, and not thinking, are they enjoying it as much as I am, or anything like any of those pressures of how you're enjoying it.
Yeah, totally. Like, I went to see There Will Be Blood on my own.
Amazing.
I know. I can't imagine having seen that with someone else. But then I suppose comedy, like I went to see Austin Powers with my mates, and there was like a big group of us, and I sort of always remember that as being a really fun night out.
Yeah, so I get that.
Maybe it's to do with the film.
Comedies and some of the bigger action things where everyone can get excited together, and I get that, but in general,
Dancing
I don't
in the
want
Dark on my own.
I screened that at my, I do a film club at the Prince Charles Cinema, and I screened Dancing in the Dark there, and it just, I'd never seen it on the big screen. The idea of the film club was to put on films I've fallen in love with but never seen on the big screen. So it's all stuff that I've had on DVD. And that one was the absolute highlight for me because I'd remembered it was... I try not to rewatch them if I'm putting it on, so it's been a bit of a while. So really, it's me being greedy. It's me just wanting to watch it.
Guys, regardless of anyone else coming. Along, that's fine, yeah, but yeah. I'm going to hire out the whole cinema.
I don't care if anyone's there, but this is my cheap way of hiring out a whole cinema. But what a film. And on the big screen, it did just make all the difference because just the performances and the silences is what excited me. And it in situations... like that, you know what, something did benefit from other people being there, because some of those prolonged silences, having that kind of silence amongst 100 other people kind of made the tension even more.
And it must be nice for you to see people seeing those films for the first time, especially when you love them. Like, I remember showing The Wicker Man to someone for the first time, not the remake. I have to always add that. God, the one with Nicolas Cage is like my favourite thing in the whole world. Where he doesn't die at the end. I haven't even seen the remake. I think he doesn't die at the end or something, or he dies, like gets eaten by bees or anyway. I mean,
come on.
Yeah. The first time I showed The Wicker Man to like my mate, it was just, she was like, because it was so hard to explain why I loved it. And I think that can be really nice. It must be great to hire out a whole, although you can't see people's faces necessarily, but you like that atmosphere.
But we do a thing at the end that, because of the dawn of the term spoiler alert, you can't talk about films. We kind of say at the end, if you want to stick around, I'm going to do kind of a Q&A about the film, despite having fuck all to do with the film. I can't claim any secret knowledge, but we all kind of stay there and discuss what we thought. So you do kind of get that excitement and niceness. And it's not... Have you had any films that, or TV shows that you've shown to people, or whether it be a friend or a partner at the time, where they've not got it? Because that's the most crippling thing for me, when you're really excited about a film
and then
they're just not enjoying it in the way they're meant to enjoy it.
Yeah, that has happened to me. I'm just trying to think of when...
it's just a painful experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think maybe it happened with Dogville.
Yeah.
Have you seen Dogville?
Yeah.
You would have done if you like... I think we're probably like similar. Just because I was trying to explain that, and I was like, you've just got to see it. I've never seen Nicole Kidman do better acting than this, blah, blah, blah. And then they just didn't quite like the fact that all the rooms were drawn out on the floor and everything. Yeah. I think they wanted it to feel more real. And it was like a real big blow for me, because I think when you really love something, you expect someone you know really well to love it too, and they don't.
Yeah.
You feel like you don't know them as well as you thought you did.
So many things, because you feel that, you also start to question why you like it, if you're right to like it, if you're just liking it because you've read somewhere it's good, and things like that. There's all sorts of things that you're saying, like, well, but it's you should, why don't you agree?
No, just say you like it if you don't.
Just pretend you're enjoying it.
I know. We used to have these film nights, like I remember we made a Wicker Man, which was like waffles.
Amazing.
Like food on the theme of a jelly baby in like a cage of waffles.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and we used to do... Oh, well, when I was living with, like, loads of other, like, young people in the early 20s, we got really into X Factor, which I'm quite embarrassed to admit, but we were always in on a Saturday night, and
kind
of just got sucked in.
It's engaging.
It is. And it was when it was television. In the early, very early days, and we got made spaghetti bolognese, but we put the bolognese on the plate first, then we put... the spaghetti in the shape of an X.
Brilliant.
But it was cooked, so it wasn't as good as the Wicker Man thing.
Yeah,
it was still,
it's a good effort,
was
though.
There.
You've got a history of food-based creations, and you've also got a wonderful podcast, which is always good to mention on other podcasts,
because
can get that out there. Things We Do for Love, or Things We Do for Love, as Northern people pronounce it, and on the first episode, it was wonderful to hear you tried to woo someone by making their face out of a roast.
Yeah, of a roast. Yeah,
I mean, that's a hell of a challenge, right? Because a face is, I mean, it's an obvious thing, but it's a very personal and distinct thing.
I know.
So to try and create,
I know. Well, I think my thing's always been like the amount of effort thrown in will yield results.
Yeah,
but has
that worked out?
I can't, with the roast face thing, we were already going out, so it was a bit wasted, because I think I sort of wanted to make him see that I was really cool.
I mean, yeah, that's clearly more of a first date thing.
wasting
this on someone that's already in the bag.
I mean, maybe better if you've never spoken to them, but you want to just go up to them, give it to them silently on a tray.
Yeah.
I did, yeah, the roast thing.
There's restaurant owners now knowing never to employ you in case you happen to like one of the people that comes in.
I've got a really good idea.
I made this of your face.
Or maybe just make everyone's faces and then, you know, just you're just hedging your bets.
Yeah.
You could make a generic face and see the customer come in and just add, quickly, get some gooseberries. They've got green eyes, that kind of
add
thing.
Add a wonky eye or a crooked nose.
Yeah.
Highlight anything.
I made a Santa's face as well, not to try and get Santa to go out with me. He doesn't exist. Sorry if any... Oh, no, what if kids are listening?
Yeah.
I mean,
that is a problem.
Father Christmas exists, but not Santa.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Everyone calls him Santa, it's the wrong name.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's similar to the whole Jesus thing, where there's a lot of different names for him.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's the body, all these different... So Santa's just... There's variations.
Yes.
And some are for a story.
Yes.
And some are for coming down your chimney and giving you presents.
Absolutely. Santa's a bit like Jesus.
Yeah, in many ways. The beard, everything else. I was once on a train and I got abused by... no older than 8 or 9 from a chavvy family, which is a term I don't like to use, but I think they were embracing that token.
Sure.
And it was one of the best kind of public heckles I've ever had, because he just said, "Are you Santa?" And I said, "No, I'm not, mate." And he went, "Then why have you got a beard and a bag?" Couldn't argue it. I was like, "Well, I've got no reason for having a beard. I just have a beard, so I can't say, well, here's the reasons." I was just like, "Whoop, whoop." Oh, I just put my headphones in and ignored him. But it's a valid argument.
But why would Santa have a beard? What would Santa say if? Well, so if he said, "Are you Santa?" and you said, "No," but you were.
Yeah.
And he said, "Why have you got a beard?" What would Santa say?
If he said, "Why have you got a beard and a bag?" he'd go, "You got me there. I am Santa. Correct. I do have a beard and a bag because I'm Santa.
So
Santa has to have a beard."
You were masquerading as Santa.
I guess so. I guess he wasn't happy with my not admitting it.
Yeah, he probably still thought you were.
I had that. This is weird. I'm just turning this into tales of my life I've not told before. I was once at the Camden Rocks type festival. What's that? Camden Calling. Was it Camden Calling?
Yeah, I know.
A rock festival in Camden. And an older woman came up to me and went, "Are you who I think you are?" And we were playing a couple of gigs that weekend. So I was like, "I don't know." It was one of the first times I was having someone potentially recognise me. And I was like, "I don't know." And she said, "Are you Ryan Gosling?" Which now is a hell of a compliment and a hell of... At the time, it was quite obscure, but I'd enjoyed him in... what was the film we did where he was a teacher that was a drug addict? Half Nelson.
Right, yes,
In Half Nelson. And he had a bit of a beard and my beard was shorter. And it was really awkward because I was saying, "Well, no, I'm not." And she was like, "I understand. It's okay. Well, I just want to say..." And it was the most awkward thing of not wanting to overdo it, but I really... I'm not. That's confirmed now. Years have gone on to prove that.
Yeah, that you're not him.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that I'm definitely not him, as he's become even more of a heartthrob. It's been undeniable that I'm not Ryan Gosling. But yeah, she completely just went away believing that I was just being coy about it and being...
And then she'll be like, "That Ryan Gosling's got real Essex accent."
yeah, he does. He does an amazing Essex accent. I don't know if he's preparing for a part or what. I want to get onto your podcast again because I really enjoyed it and I really liked it started, and I thought this might not work because it's things we do for love, and it's about that. It's talking to a guest about different things that I've done for love. And my concern was, right, as soon as it started, there was some implication that you've got a few stories there. So I thought we've got the backbone, but I was instantly thinking as a guest, I guess if you've prepared and thought about it, but it was amazing. There were so many good stories and back and forth, even from the audience and the crowd. And yeah, what made you think of that? Or was it something you realised that you had a lot of weird or embarrassing things you'd done over the years, or just, you know, assumed a lot of other people will too?
Yeah, it was like that. I've written a book, and in that there was a lot of stuff about love, and I realised that I've got more... When it's your life, you don't necessarily realise that those stories aren't run-of-the-mill until you put them on paper or talk about them, and people are like, "You did what?"
Yeah.
So,
and generally the moments will be, you'll be telling friends in the future about it. It won't be friends at the time, because it'll all be, everyone's in it and it doesn't matter, but in the future, go, "This happened,"
absolutely.
They'll be like, what the hell are you?
Yeah, or especially mates who weren't there. Like when you look back on a time of your life and you're like, I did loads of stuff then that I thought was normal and isn't. Maybe not even to do with love, like whatever you were doing. I sort of realised I had this sort of back catalogue of stuff that I hadn't used in my live shows, and some which I had, but kind of always wanted to do a podcast, and then thought about, I'd done a few interviews. I made like a couple of Radio 4 documentaries about stuff and had to interview people, which I hadn't really done before. I interviewed a few people on Radio 4 Extra for like the comedy club, and I really, really liked doing it. And I really like doing it about warm subjects rather than, so I realised that I think my strength is getting stuff out of people and making myself the object of a joke first, so that they feel comfortable enough to reveal, rather than if I'm ever asked to sort of do more stuff like, I don't know, more serious stuff, not that I'm ever asked to, like, like Paxman, but the more factual it is, I think the less good I am.
We need to send you out to Syria.
They just need someone who can make Santa's face out of a rose. I thought, what platform can I create where I can just chat to people? Also, I really, really didn't want it to be gag, or at least I didn't want it to be set up like that. So obviously,
like set routine and set routine.
Yeah, and it's say to people, sometimes you're doing, perhaps not so much with podcasts, but maybe with like panel shows, and that it's obvious that, you know, you really have got to write jokes beforehand, and that's fine, that's the brief.
It's fascinating because there's been a thing in America recently where a few of the podcast festivals have been starting, and it seems a lot of the bigger American podcasts are more like the panel shows, and the festivals have kind of had a negative effect because seeing it live has exposed how scripted at points it is. It will be blah, 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 and then someone will be going over their story that they've got. And when you're listening, it doesn't have that. And the British podcasts, and as said, The Things We Do For Love was one of them. It felt that it was just completely, certain things felt they were, hadn't been thought about in years and were returned to on that in that moment.
Oh,
kind of thing.
Good, because that's really what I wanted, and I think it should. I feel like the podcast shouldn't be a prepared thing. Ideally, I feel like it should have a homemade feel to it, and that anyone can make them, and that's the good thing about them. And I think with, because that was the first one that you listened to. I've done with the one with Josh Widdicombe, and then we're going to record a few before we release the next ones.
Yeah.
But Josh was brilliant as well. And, you know, he said, so is there any prep? And I was like, no, things I don't quite know what it is yet anyway, but all I can tell you is that we'll just have a chat and it'll be great. It's just very relaxed, and don't worry. I won't ask you about your current relationship. I think, you know, there's probably a concern when people get asked to do it, that I'll be like, you know, what do you think your bad points are in a relationship? But I'm not interested in any of that. I just want to know, like, what people did when they were eight to do with, like, Tizer and stuff.
And it tends, again, I'm building everything off of one episode here, but it tends to have that feel that it's stuff that's past the point of it being an awkward question or awkward conversation. It's not trying to go, so that girl I saw you with last year, what kind of... like, don't want to get into that.
It just doesn't matter.
You know, it's more growing up and
all
that.
Yeah, it's more, I suppose, about loss of innocence. And one of my big things always in everything I do, I suppose, is trying to retain a sense of, like, wonder and joy about life, and to keep talking to strangers and stuff like that. So I think I'm always up for embracing that. And it feels like the podcast is skewed like that. So it's kind of like, I don't know, the first time you ever tried to get someone to fancy you, what did you do? Because you've got no point of reference. Like, I remember going up to James Price when I was 10 and he was 8, and I wanted to go out with him, but I didn't understand. I didn't know what going out with someone was. So I just said, I love you, do you love me? And he said, yeah. And then it was like so simple.
Yeah.
We only went out for about a week, but we were 10
Hell
and 8.
Of a week.
So yeah, best week of my life, bought me a Ferrari. But like, that's what the kind of stuff I'm interested in, where you made a bit of a twat of yourself because you were innocent,
and
not because you had
really
any
understand.
Agenda.
Yeah.
And of course, I think with Robbins, we did get onto like drunken stuff and kind of, but he was a great guest because he's kind of like a bit like a tortured poet in some ways.
Yeah.
And Josh was brilliant because he talked a lot about like primary school and about his dad making bread. And so all these kinds of
stuff. I can imagine Josh to be a great one for that because he is such a naturally lovable character, but he's also very honest and open, it seems, in a lot of his stand up and things like that. It seems real stories of, it's not all gone well in my life. This isn't, you know, I've had a rough time at points. And
it's a very unthreatening There's no, it feels like Josh is, there's no kind of rough edges. He's just a very warm and genial presence. Robbins is more like an Edgar Allan Poe creation.
100%. Like, yeah. 100%.
He drinks a lot of ale.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because when I first started to see a lot of your stuff, stand-up wise and some songs and things like that, it was around the same time that I was enjoying a lot of Josie Long's stuff and a few other people, and it seemed to be the women in the comedy industry that were taking the step of making comedy that didn't have to be cynical or negative. And a lot of comedy I love is cynical and negative.
Yeah,
and it
me
seemed
too.
That there was a few that were just going, right, no, it doesn't have to be laughing at someone or something. It, or if that someone is someone, it can be me.
It can be me.
If
you know what I mean. No,
was that a conscious thing that you, even though you may have been into some more cynical comedy, that you wanted to be more?
No, it wasn't a conscious thing. I think I only ever write what I can write, what feels most natural. However, I think you're influenced by your mates, and Josie and I, from the moment we met, were just gotten so well.
Yeah.
And then I suppose, if I think of my good mates in comedy, it's people like Josie and Pappies and Bridget.
Yeah.
And
I still need to see Bridget. I've never seen Bridget. Yeah, I've just heard nothing but amazing things.
I'll get her on the podcast at some point. She's fantastic. But I mean, Josie started off when she was like one, but me and Bridge started at the same time. And so it's like school years, you retain a bond with, because you're all doing the same shit gigs. Yeah. And I mean, it's like you get there and, you know, there's like two people in the audience and it still goes ahead. And so you know each other's routines off by heart, and you kind of. So I'm sure that we influenced each other without knowing it, but I never made a conscious decision. And then I was surprised when I started to get described as like quirky or whimsical. I don't really like the word whimsical, because if I saw something described as whimsical, I'd think it sounds a bit sort of pastely. And
see, it's strange, because it's quite a British term, isn't it? Because there's a bit of a scene in LA of some great underground rap that a lot of them are dubbing it as, or choosing to put themselves as whimsical,
right,
because it's quite surreal and quite unusual and quite stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's weird, because I think in England, no rapper in England would ever want to be referred to as whimsical. But Open Mike Eagle and Serengeti and a few of these guys, and Milo, it's kind of put in as like, whimsical is one of the terms that's thrown in there. And hearing that, I was like, this is beautiful, that it's this cool underground thing, but because in this country you'd be like,
it's just
not whimsical, how dare you, that seems patronizing.
It feels a bit of a diss. I don't know. I think oddball is okay. Feels more solid. Think something about whimsical that feels, well, I suppose a whim that you're doing on a whim, that
you've not put effort
might
in.
See you today, you're talking about fairies, and then they might see the next day and you might talk about badgers, whereas, you know, routines are really well honed.
In many ways that's kind of, again, not trying to justify anyone calling you whimsical, but in many ways that's a compliment, because it shows how natural you're making a performance seem. And Stuart Lee is one for that point. It's obviously on the other end of whimsical, but there's been a routines of his I've watched, and I just saw his latest episode of the Comedy Vehicle. It's a piece I'd seen him do at one of Robin Ince's end of year things, which I saw you at as well. One year, and I genuinely at points was thinking, man, he's just going off, he's lost the crowd and he's going off and really getting quite angry. And then watching it on the show, it was word for word, it was the exact same reactions to specific people in the crowd, and you're like, because again I thought that, and then at the end it had the payoff and was classically Stuart Lee, just amazing. But seeing it on the show was like, right, I like to think of myself as an informed a comedy fan, but you completely had me in the palm of your hand with everyone else in that room who was kind of going, it's getting beyond a joke now that he's getting quite angry about this and that. And so in a way, if it is seen as whimsical and throwaway, then it's like, well, more for you. I pull this whimsicalness off every night.
It's the same whimsical thing every night.
I can be whimsical like that at the flick of a switch.
I've been doing this whimsical material for 10 years, but I'm never going to change it.
My whimsy is so honed, the most honed whimsy in the industry. You mentioned panel shows, briefly, and the thought that you didn't want the podcast to be like a panel show where you do have to prepare material. How have you found panel shows? Because you've been on the hot list. Like, I always find that I love 8 out of 10 Cats. I love Have I Got News For You and Mock the Week and things like that. But then if you can also get on QI, then that's the golden moment as well. And you seem to have jumped across all of them. So how do you find them?
I didn't. So it depends. I think that they're a different skill from stand-up. Yeah. I think that it's...
That's been the fascinating thing to hear from Josie, from Sarah Pascoe. And sadly, more from women I seem to hear it, that it seems a far harder skill because... I don't know, traditionally there's been less women on, therefore Josie seemed to feel it was a stranger reaction, kind of the crowd are already on side of your hosts or whatever else, and you have to, I don't know, it feels like you're starting from under.
Maybe. I to be honest, that isn't the first thing that springs to my mind. The thing that springs to my mind first is that when you're newer, it's hard.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm still often the newest act on, so... Or the youngest. That doesn't happen as much now. I suppose, like, I did Cats the other day with Joe Lycett, who's younger than me. I still think of myself as 22, then I realise that. But, you know, that way that you're like, and then you go, oh, my God.
That's the trait of having any job that's in the arts, because you never have to feel like you've grown up.
Yeah,
you
can forget like, I think of Arthur Smith as 22.
Yeah, exactly,
And actually, he can probably do more than most 22-year-olds anyway. Like, you know, when he's at festival, he just does all the gigs. But I think for me, it's more that it's very hard when you're first in them because of you being the kind of rookie person. So people are less likely to know who you are, which is harder, definitely. If you go on and you're... If you go on and you're Bill Bailey, or if you go on and you're... like Lee Mack or whatever, or Joe Brand, the audience understands your shtick, and it's so much about shtick in panel shows.
And they're ready. They've paid their money or not paid their money, but they're there to laugh at you, if you know what I mean. They're kind of prepared for that. I had Kathy Burke on last week, and we were kind of discussing how weird it is when you start to get your own audience. It can be hard to tell if you're keeping as high a standard, because you've got an audience who really want to enjoy your stuff. So it's kind of, it can be a
especially
hard
when
thing
you're doing
there.
Previews, that's hard because it might be they may not know it's a preview, they may not know what a preview is. I didn't know what one was until I started doing Edinburgh. I didn't understand people would be coming on with notes and whatever. So I think if you're doing previews and you've got a bit of a fan base, then it can get more difficult because they sort of like, that might be the only time they're ever going to see you. So they want to laugh a lot, and that's really nice of them, but it can be hard to gauge. So what I've got to do quite a few. Yeah. And actually, that's why doing previews in, I don't know, a massive room in Leamington Spa where people don't know who's on and haven't heard of you can be quite good. Although it's horrible at the time, because you really see, like, in the stark, cold, clinical atmosphere, what jokes work and what don't.
You go on thinking, I want to know what works, and come out going, I wish I never knew that was hideous, that was painful.
just don't do it as your last preview before your first Edinburgh show like I did. I was like, oh my God, the whole thing is absolutely... but with panel shows, I think that's the main thing for me. I think that's why it's got slightly easier, that the more you do, the easier it gets. I think the woman thing probably is a thing, but for me, it's not, definitely not. It doesn't feel like a big, I don't know why. It just doesn't, maybe I don't let it enter my head because I can't change that about myself.
Good to hear though, because again, it's good. I've had issues, or I've had discussions in the past of on this podcast, and I feel on podcasts in general, so I'm on side of anyone that says this, but the guests tend to be very male weighted and that's an issue, but it's not a conscious choice. And annoys me when people say, can you have more women on? It's like, well, tell me specific women you'd like to have on, because otherwise it feels disrespectful to say just anyone that's...
Well, that was the weird thing when they brought in that rule about... Because, you know, when they brought in that rule about there's got to be one woman on every... So I was asked about how I felt about that, as was, I'm sure, most of the women on the circuit. And I just said, well, I don't really do enough panel shows to, like... At that point, so weird things happen. Since I had a baby 18 months ago, and I've got better at panel shows since then. Because I think for two reasons. One is that you focus so much more when you've got a kid on work, because for me, everything's compartmentalised. Like, I'm either have a day looking after her and I just do a few emails if I have to, but I'm just with her and I love it. Or if I'm having a block of time when I'm working, I try and focus on the work so that I can get back to her. Like, everything's kind of... Whereas before, when I didn't have any kids, it was like, I don't know, I worry more about... Yeah. I sort of think, who am I on with? Or can I find out who I'm on with? Or they're probably going to talk loads. God, what if I don't say anything for the first 20 minutes, which is the worst thing? And then you think, oh my God, I haven't spoken for 20 minutes. And you just start saying, yeah, yeah, after everything that someone else says. Yeah. And that just doesn't count as talking. But there's no time to worry about that, because you're sort of having to just go, right, okay, she's all right. Yeah, right, leaving her, right, I'll be back in 3 hours. I'm going, you know. So it's so much better.
It's kind of beautiful to not have that overthinking time, because there's something you realise there's other things that are more important than worrying about that one little thing you're doing.
And then you're more confident as well, because you're just kind of like, everything becomes really black and white, and you've had like 3 hours sleep and you're like, okay, I'm gonna do it. I'll just, you know, I'll have my, you know, kind of coke or whatever, and then I'll just go on. And so I'm definitely better at them. And the other reason is that you're aware that you are keeping someone alive and you have to earn money, so it becomes more easy to look at work and go, I can't justify saying no to that because I think that I might be shit on it. I've got to do it and take the risk, because I've got to go there and do it.
Yeah,
and that's better. I think that's better, because it leaves less of a grey area. So if, you know, maybe everyone should just have a baby.
And I love that. I've referenced it so many times, but I had Stephen Graham on a month or so ago, and one of the things that he said is he thinks actors, and he was speaking more on actors, but I think it translates across the whole kind of industry of comedy and music, can overthink gigs. And essentially, his argument was, my job is an actor. So if I was a painter and someone said, I want you to paint my house, I'd go and paint their house. I wouldn't think, what's the benefits of this? And is this right? You'd kind of, and again, there has to be a level of selectiveness, but again, that's a beautiful thing where you're a mother now, an element of that is taken out, because you're like, right, well, I need to go and do that job, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It also explains why you've not been to the cinema in the daytime in a while. That's a great reason and explanation.
Yeah, that was my first. I still felt really guilty. I was like, I should be working. I'm going to do it. Then you look at the duration. It's like, it's over 2 hours. I better be good. That's the problem. Yeah. That's why, you know, have you ever had that at gigs where you're sometimes, you know, people have come and see you and they've had to get a babysitter, and you're aware that it's cost them, you know, probably 70, 80 quid. Yeah. Like, when you break it down, you think, oh my God, I never used to think about that.
Yeah.
So yeah, you could do this thing, like, oh, it better be good, it better be
and
good.
And knowing how rare a night out is in those situations. So it's like, it's not just, oh, we'll catch a gig. It's like, this is our gig for the year.
This is our gig for the decade.
The pressure on there.
I know.
Obviously, we don't have to go into it in huge detail, because it's a very personal thing, but how are you finding it? Kind of 18 months in, you must have found your feet and kind of be...
I mean, I have some level of understanding. Yeah, I love it. It's everything that I was told it would be, but that I didn't really understand until I did it. It can be very tough, especially when you're tired and you sort of are crying. You don't understand why. You want to help them and all that. But now she's a bit older. It's getting more and more exciting, and you know, she's talking. And I from day one, I was completely in love with her, and it became clear that we would have to be very organised with our diaries. But my boyfriend looks after her half the time. She goes to the childminder a few days a week, and sometimes we get a bit of other help if we're both working at the same time. But generally, it sort of ends up us spending sort of 3 or 4 days a week just us looking after him. We do half and half, so she is 50% of the time with him, and that's great, you know, for both of us.
It's lovely to be able to have that balance, because it can be a tough thing. Obviously there's tough areas on either side, but if one is staying at home, then they're having that huge hard job of, as you said, keeping a human alive on their own. But then if the other is out of work, then they're having that hard task of trying to bond in the same way when they're there a fraction of the time. So that's a perfect situation, really, that you're in jobs and in professions that you can kind of go, right, this is us together. We're both raising this child and both providing.
It does really feel like that. I think also, if you're the one working, you can feel guilty, because work can feel like a day off. If you're looking after a kid on your own all the time, if you're at home, that is a very different situation from me. Some of my mates who don't work, I think they have a very different experience, and more intense. And if you sometimes you just feel like you can't get out of the house if you're
particularly
pre, when they're young.
Exactly, and particularly pre the speech stage, because there's so much where it's just they just need you. You don't know why, you can't find out why, you can't learn why. There's just There's nothing
and stuff
I can
like,
do.
Yeah, I mean, stuff like you realise you haven't eaten all day, you haven't, and it's so hard to explain. When you think, well, what have I done that? I've changed their nappy, but you can't, and it's hard to cope. It can be very hard to cope at times, and it can be psychologically hard if you don't go out of the house all day. And sometimes you have the best intentions, and then she wouldn't sleep in her buggy when she was little. So I'd sort of think, oh, I've got to be back for her naps and blah, blah. So I think as time goes on, it becomes more easy to go out and to meet up with other people and to go, okay, I'm just going to do this and see what happens, and then it pays off. I didn't have the confidence to do that early on, especially because she wouldn't sleep in the buggy. So then you're kind of like, oh, just stay in all day.
And confidence must be a huge thing in that situation, because I'm sure, again, I seem to just be referencing other people's quotes, but Joe Rogan always had a quote that I love, that he kind of said, do you remember when we were kids and we thought that there was such thing as an adult? And then he's learnt now that no one actually ever tells you how it all works or what to do. You just kind of don't know. And that must be the huge thing of when having a child, of you expecting everything to come to you and then go, right, it's not. So I need to just figure this out and do as best I can.
Yeah.
And when that confidence grows, it must be a huge thing. When you get through 6 months, like, they're alive still.
Yeah, totally.
I've managed to keep a human alive.
Yeah, that wasn't my mate Gavin, really. Like, at the end of the first week, I rang him and I was crying and stuff. Yeah. And just I was trying to breastfeed and had problems. I mean, I think with the breastfeeding thing, like, I know Adele spoke about it recently because she got a bit upset with Jamie Oliver for saying, you know, not enough women in this country breastfeed and all that. And she was like, sometimes you can't and it can be really hard. And I had problems and ended up doing giving her half a bottle and half breastfeeding. This probably isn't going to be of interest to everyone, but that was the heaviest thing on my mind at the beginning for whatever reason. I think because you're hormonal, you can really feel like a failure. I didn't expect it to be an issue. I didn't know I'd feel that strongly about it. Anyway, I rang. Yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to just agree that it's a tough thing for anyone to give any solid comment on, because it's such on an individual basis, an individual situation. Sometimes, as I said, it's a physical thing. Sometimes it's a functional or there's numerous reasons.
There's so many different reasons. And also you just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you can't predict things about birth, and you can't predict how you're going to feel, and you can't predict what you're going to be able to do physically.
And at that point, particularly when you are so hormonal, and that sounds like a cop out to put it on hormones, but it's a huge fucking deal.
Absolutely. You can't, you know, you need a month off in a spa but you can't have that.
You really can't. But for anyone to give any reason to make you feel you're doing something wrong or in some way shortchanging this being that is suddenly everything to you, that's crippling, right? I can understand Adele getting annoyed at Jamie or things like that.
Me too. I understand what Jamie was Jamie, my best mate. I understand what Jamie was trying to do. That's just what he's like. Good old J-O. I can understand what he was trying to do. And I think both of them are kind of right. And I think it's a fantastic thing to do if it's right for you. But I wish that someone had said to me, if you can't manage to do every single feed yourself, don't worry, because it doesn't have to be. I thought as soon as I gave her one bottle, that would be it. It would be like you with coffee, that she'd be like, right, I'm not going to. Yeah. But it wasn't. I think if you can pick the right time to do it, and we just did great doing half and half for ages. And I just wish I'd known that it didn't have to be all or nothing. Because you can really beat yourself up. So that was
completely.
All that stuff's going on in the early days. And that's why, I think that's why it gets easier.
Yeah, because you realise that it can be. I don't know why I'm speaking as if I've got any experience or knowledge on this, but it's that feeling of it is kind of all about a compromise. You'll have your ideal thing before a child is born. You'll have, they're not going to watch any TV or things like this. And then there'll be a point of, right, actually, a little bit of TV here just so I can shower or something like that.
It's
like
phone.
These human things. It's like they're not failures. And the point that you can realise there's compromises rather than failures, then that's got to be a huge thing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's to me what life is about. Like, 100%. You can be, I think people do that with relationships sometimes as well, don't they? Like, I used to have a mate who'd always be like, he can't be this. He can't have gone to public school because that would upset my dad because we're a working class family. You know, he can't have. And then in the end, you think, but actually, if you meet someone and you like them, then maybe he might have got a scholarship somewhere, or maybe he is really posh, but he's really nice. And, you know, saying as if posh is like the worst thing. Maybe he is really racist, but he's nice. Like, I mean, posh is
genuinely,
the worst
thing. It's taken me years to get over. My main prejudice was exactly that. I realised if I met someone who had a posh accent, I'd instantly be a bit, all right, mate, whatever kind of thing. And that's a bad thing.
I know.
It wasn't until I made some good friends who were posh that I was like, okay. It's like, again, it sounds like I'm now saying some of my best friends are posh. I'm not poshest, but
no. But it is. It depends. It's just to do with your background, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I'm from quite a small town, and there was one posh school there, and like, I just went to the normal comprehensive, and I think, to me, growing up now, I think I agree with that quote that, you know, you don't like get a manual, and you don't.
Yeah.
But I also think that growing up is an attitude rather than what you're doing. So I never want to feel grown up, and I never want to feel like I'm regarded as grown up. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But to me, if someone said, oh, you're sensible now, I'd feel really like, am I? Well, then I'm going to have to like get on a flight to Prague with someone I've never met.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know why that is. I guess it might be to do with our jobs or, and yet there are people at primary school who sort of always seemed grown up, like they seemed to know what they were doing and they didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was trying to live my life. Like, do you remember that screensaver? I don't think anyone has it anymore. Where it was like a ball bouncing around and it hits. So on the computer, I don't know if it breaks things, but it's like it takes up the whole screen and it just bounces around and bounces off the walls.
Yes, yes, I remember.
I've always tried to live my life like that. I've always sort of tried things, and I've always gone yes, but basically always said yes. Mm. Like, I jumped off a bridge when I was 13 for a bet because I said yes when someone dared me to jump off it and broke my ankle. But so sometimes it hasn't paid off.
Choices.
Yeah. But I've always had that attitude, and I feel like some people don't want to live like that.
Yeah.
And I think I used to think that those people were twats, and now I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't want to necessarily read any more books in your life, or you'll think, oh, you know what, I don't want to travel to any new countries. I used to think, like, oh God, what a pity. And now I'm like, oh, well, you probably just have a nice time in your house eating apple crumble or something.
Yeah,
like,
it's
who
a massive
am I to
realization
judge you?
That people don't all have to be the same, isn't it?
And people don't have to have the same attitude as you, and there's nothing wrong with that. It might make them slightly less interesting to hang out with, but it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with them.
As long as they're happy with that. I remember when I worked in HMV and being a massive music nerd for years, I had a realisation that some people don't, like, there's a quote I read somewhere that James Blunt and Dido, they described them as music for people who aren't into music.
Right.
And I don't think that's an insult. I think that's a real thing, and it's when you've grown up absolutely in love with music and it being such an inspiration and such a guide to you, it's hard to get your head around that some people don't feel like that, and some people just want something nice on in the background, and that's absolutely fine.
I bet that's like when I used to work for Robbins, it's like we're going through the chains that we used to work for.
Yeah.
But when I used to work for Robbins, I've got like the equivalent of a GMBQ in wine tasting, because I used to work in the call centre, like sending wine out, but they take it really seriously, really do. It was brilliant training. We used to do loads of tastings. We used to get sent on tastings and stuff.
Amazing.
And at the end of them, one of my bosses was like, what's your favourite wine now? And I said Wolf Blass. And Wolf Blass is like a range of wine, which is normally around £6 or £7.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh my God, I can't believe out of all the things you've picked Wolf Blass. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, but I like it. And I don't want to spend £30 on a bottle of wine, because I can't like justify spending that much on it. And I,
part of the psychological enjoyment you're having is that you're not spending a load of money and having to feel guilty. Again, it's the working class versus posh thing. The fact that you're going, if I was drinking a £50 bottle of wine, even if it was a really nice, I'd still be thinking,
I've just spent 50 quid on a bottle of wine, on a drink.
I know.
It's not even a hot drink.
Yeah, exactly. I could heat it up on a fire, exactly. But it's probably going to ruin the taste. Yeah, totally. And also, because I've done all the tastings, I was like, I have tasted really expensive wine. Yeah. But I know what... So I think it's a similar thing. Like, not everyone... There's an absolute place for Dido and James Blunt. And I think that's a really important thing that you said. Like, I remember reading this interview with Louis Walsh, where he was like, when people say... so-and-so shit. Mm. You know, like any big act will get haters, but I feel like perhaps James Blunt, and he's so funny on Twitter.
He's brilliant.
Amazing.
On Twitter.
I mean,
absolute hilarity.
God, it's genuinely, I read it and I'm like, I'll never be as good as that. I'll never be as funny as that. Like, how is it that he's.
But, it's amazing.
Like, with him, you can't say that he's shit. It's such a sort of juvenile thing to say because even though I listen to the really famous song of his and go, this doesn't chime with me. It doesn't move me. Like, it doesn't excite me to listen to it. It doesn't mean it's shit.
Yeah,
it just
means
that I can see that it's musically dexterous and that it's so catchy.
Yeah. I kind of argue that a lot online of saying, no, it's not to your taste.
Yeah.
And even if it's something that's not to my taste, it's still, as like, you're right there, because anything in the arts, I keep referring to the arts, I sound like such an idiot, but anything in those areas, it's individual taste. There's no right or wrong or good or shit.
Yeah, you know? That's true. And it isn't just a matter of semantics. Like, people might go, well, I'll just say it isn't to my taste, but I'll think that it's shit. But if you say it isn't to your taste, it still leaves you open, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
So it's more interesting to say it isn't to my taste, but why do other people like it? Oh yeah, I can see why. But if you just go, it's shit, I think it makes you more closed, and if you're a creative person, I think it makes what you create narrower and narrower.
Yeah. It draws me to look at stuff more. I don't know if it's a stubbornness, but if I see someone vehemently slagging off a particular song that's big, it makes me go, right, I need to have a look at that, because why do they hate it so much? Yet and a recent one was a Rihanna's work, and I got really into it, because I honestly hadn't heard it, and I'd heard everyone talking about it, but it hadn't crossed my path. And then one mate, I did a Facebook post saying, I've just accidentally heard this on the radio and it's awful and all this. I was like, wow, I wonder, it's weird, it advertised it to me. I was like, I'll give that a listen.
Yeah,
and the fact is, it was a catchy pop song, and yeah.
Well, it's like me admitting that I like The X Factor. I was watching it when we were making the spaghetti bolognese in the shape of The X Factor. I don't watch it now, but like, people would be like, how can you really like Frank Zappa and really like The X Factor? Yeah. And it's like, because they do different things for me on a Saturday night. I don't want to listen. I just want to like veg out in front of a telly.
And context was key there, saying on a Saturday night. I had someone... Only one time, I've been doing a club night for years now at the book club, and one time I had someone come up to me and going, oh, what are you doing, man? Like, while I'm DJing, I was like, what? He's like, play the real hip-hop and that. And I don't play at my club night the same kind of hip-hop I'd play on my radio show at XFM, because the fact is, if I'm in a club and I'm drunk, which generally if I'm DJing I am, I want to hear club bangers. I don't want to hear really thought-provoking songs about hurt and things like that. It's not what you want to hear in a club. You want to hear anti-app, and you want to hear just these big songs. And as I said, it's context. You don't have to agree with everything in the lyrics, for example, but in that context, it's right for that moment.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why it's
on Saturday nights.
All you want is spaghetti bolognese in the shape of the X Factor. Tea, Wolf Blass. And Wolf Blass, a lot of advertising.
They're getting a lot of love. So did you grow up in Derbyshire, was it? Born in Hull and grew up in Derbyshire.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've got access to Wikipedia and blown away by my knowledge here. But so how was that? And what were you drawn towards? Because the exciting thing that I've got here is from you saying that you have always had the outlook of just saying yes to try many things. And that comes across in your career with all the different areas. As I said, the first question of what are you is the one that we don't ever need to answer, which is great. We can kind of get going at it. So when you growing up, was there kind of, oh, I want to be a comedian, or was there, I want to be an actress, or was it just, I want to do interesting stuff? You know?
Yeah, I think when I was growing up, it was always actress, but then I started to write songs at about 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. So got the guitar, and then I used to write little sketches and stuff and play all the different parts myself and record them on cassette tape. And I'm sure that if the internet had been around then, I would have put them online. It's probably very good that it wasn't, yeah. to be honest. But providing this like play about a court case where someone had stolen loads of tennis rackets.
Brilliant.
I mean, it was all improvised. But I mean, you know, and we used to do plays and stuff.
Have you got them anywhere now? Have you got
my mum's probably got them in like a shoebox somewhere. I should try and find them. Yeah.
Find if they're wonderful in their innocence or horrendous in their pretension.
Yeah, you're right. I should, because I got asked to do, there's a show called My Teenage Diary on Radio 4.
Right.
That I got asked to do, and I found My Teenage Diaries and I couldn't do the show because it was just too, like, sad. My diaries were just like, I hate life. I don't, it was really.
Oh, there's a documentary on Netflix that's the same thing, and it was a big live show that got big in America of people, yeah. just getting up and reading from their diary, and someone recommended it, and it blew me away. I never had a diary, sadly, but it was just, you get, again, it's similar, I guess, in a way, to what I enjoyed about things we do for love, in that you get some ridiculous stuff, and then out of nowhere, something genuinely poignant will come through, and you won't be ready for that, because you've been laughing at what idiots we all made of ourselves as, yeah. kids, and then it'll be, this was a beautiful thing that happened when we didn't have that overhanging pressure of sexuality or of anything else, you, yeah. know, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting, yeah. one, but yeah.
That's my favourite thing, actually, I think, when... That's why I love, like, Phil Kay.
Yeah.
Because it's like a child... It's like being in a childlike dream world, and then he'll sort of say something incredibly profound, yeah. and quite brutal, and it sort of pierces through... Oh, that's my favourite thing.
Amazing. So you started... To write songs and then started improvising.
Yeah, so I started
plays.
To write songs. Yeah, it started. Then there used to be this play called Mrs. Morello's Hat Shop that me and my sister used to do with my friend Ruth. And amazing. I would always like write it and direct it and probably be quite bossy, I imagine. God, I was very shy though. But I think if I was secure enough, I was very shy, sort of outside the home and quite quiet. Mm-hmm. But I think when it came to Mrs. Morello's Hat Shop, there was only one director.
And it's beautiful because when you're in the confines of something that you can justify removing that shyness, that often seems to be a great trigger for people to find their creativity. It's like, in general, you're shy, but here's a valid and reasoned excuse to not be shy, because someone has to make Mrs. Morello's Hat Shop work and, yeah. come across correctly.
The audience is in the living, yeah. room. They're ready.
I can't be... Art won't let me be shy right now because it needs this to work.
They need to know what happens to the Trilby hat. Like,
exactly.
It was actually basically the plot of Mr. Ben, but people, brilliant. Used to put on a hat and then they'd be transported like Narnia into...
Amazing, the, yeah, simplicity.
I know. So yeah, I used to do stuff like that, and I was always in like youth theatre and all that, but I was very much not a typical sort of like stage kid. I used to always get put on the back row and everything because I was so quiet, but then at home... I would sort of do all these improvisations in different accents and stuff. So I suppose, like, looking back, that I was always destined to write my own stuff as well as, yeah. like, act in other people's stuff.
Yeah.
It's the only thing... So when I had sort of some quite troubled teenage years, like a lot of people, just sort of that thing of, like, growing up and going, oh, the world's shit. The only thing that I could really hold on to was that I always had a crystal clear ambition that I was going to do acting and then writing as well.
So how was it when you got, I mean, obviously you've done a lot of work and there's too much to go through, but the obvious one to go to is Peep Show, which has become an iconic and classic comedy show. So how was it when that role came along, and as the show grew and grew, I mean, it was instantly quite big, but then it seems to just really have taken on that iconic status. As how was that to get in that moment and run with it, I guess?
Well, I didn't know when I went into it that I was ever going to be in for more than a series, and at any, yeah. point I never knew if I was going to be carried over to the next series. So I would have felt differently if someone had said to me when I got the part, you'll be in it from series 5 to the end. And I think in a way it was really good not to think like that.
I say it must be nice because it makes you appreciate and really put everything into that moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Thinking it's your only chance to be there and be part of this. I had, had Michael Socker on the other week, who's from This Is England and from Derbyshire as well.
Yeah, yeah. Lawrence Socker's brother, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And we realised that almost every series he's been in, he's been brought in for a few episodes or one series, and then they've kept him around. And it was a weird thing to go through. So, like, how did this come about? It's like, well, I was meant to only be in 2.
yeah,
by the end of,
yeah.
it, like, it's a beautiful thing, though, because I guess you then have, you're putting everything in there and you're not
resting on your laurels,
way you've
or
got
knowing
less pressure than someone going, you know, you're going to be in da-da-da. So because you're like, oh, okay, I'll just do this bit, and then they
and
like
it's
you.
A
and
scary
they want,
commitment as well to think, right, if I accept this role, that's because TV takes up a lot of time and it's going to be over long periods.
Definitely,
I may be turning down all these other opportunities.
Yeah, and you have to, like, I think it happens in America more, that you have to say, like, if you do a pilot in America, you have to sign a thing at, like, a pilot stage saying, like, if this goes to series, I'll be available for blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But with Shameless, it happened. Like, I did the last series of Shameless, and I was a regular in that. So I was sort of in Manchester, basically, for 3 months. And then I think with that, I signed something that said, if it goes again, I'll make myself available to be in it. Again, it wasn't a guarantee that my character would be in it, but you sort of have to say. And then it didn't. That became the last series. So, but
it's,
I remember...
It's scary with stuff like that, because it seems that it'll always be with a certain vagueness that you're agreeing to these things.
Of course,
but when it comes
to it... You might get onto set and be like, my name is Maria.
Exactly. But then when it comes to it, it's the biggest, well, you did say... It's like, well,
I know.
You know, it seemed vague originally, but yeah.
That's why it's hard... That's why I think it's hard when you're just an actor.
Yeah.
Because you I always think this when I'm filming, like, you're part of a machine, but when the camera's on you, especially when it's a close up, you can sometimes think, oh my God, if I fuck up, especially if it's towards the end of the day, you think, if I get my line wrong, or if this isn't a great take, we have to go again.
And I'm holding everyone up.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, you've got a lot of power when you're an actor, say, like, someone of the level of, I don't know, Ben Stiller or something, where he'll get asked to do something because he's Ben Stiller. And I think then you've got a lot of power and you can say, look, I'm not working on these days. And I imagine, you know. But often you think, I'm completely replaceable. And you hear of these things where people will go and film for a week or two and then they'll get recast. It's nothing to do with their ability. It's just casting is a really tricky, delicate business. And, you know,
I think that's a really good, as scary as it seems, I think that's a really good awareness to have, though, of the, if you're not the lead big person, of how replaceable it is, and therefore how you can't arrest on your laurels or
no, I don't think you can. You also can't stop being a dick, you know. And you do see it. I think you see it start to happen when people become more successful. Sometimes that they'll be like, oh, you know, just treating runners badly and stuff like that. And I hate that. I hate it.
Completely.
I think you've always got to have it in you, to be honest. But I think some people, it's allowed to come out. And I think. You can't be very happy if you're like that. But I also think you can't really be like that for that long, because you might start to lose work. I think even if you're at the very top of your game...
Completely. If people don't want to work with you... Because the fact is, and it ties in on both things that you were saying there, if you feel, again, you're at the end of a day and you're holding people up, you're holding people up who were there before you got there and will be there after you got there, and... I won't get to put the TV on and point and say, look, that's me.
Yeah, it's they're just doing a job
and working hard.
They don't even watch it.
Of rigging lights and doing all this other stuff. So it's such, so much more of a commitment in many ways on their part than on your part. So it feels like it should be impossible to go, well, fuck that guy, he's only the light. And or else it should be the opposite of that. But equally... Those people, because they don't have that exposure and excitement, they're the people that can go, well, no, he was a dick, I don't want to work with him again.
Yeah, and I'd hate...
Simple as that.
I'd hate any
as that.
Stories to go around about me where they were like, she was a dick. But
I've only heard a few. There's been two or three at the most.
Yeah, that's good.
None, obviously.
It was
obviously.
Santa. Yeah, Santa thinks I'm a dick for making his face out. But that you can't go the other way. You can't go too far the other way where you're like, I'm so grateful to be here. Was that all right? You know, because the other side of it is that if you're too kind of like grateful to be there and too nervous and you want feedback after every take and stuff, that just won't happen because things move on really quickly. So I feel like you're sort of always treading this tightrope between being healthily confident about what you're doing and trusting your own instincts and not letting that spill over into being like, I'm the king of the castle,
I think
queen of the castle.
As well, what you said earlier of having faith in the people you're working with.
Yeah, it's so very important.
Then you don't like that kind of thing of, right, if they think we've got that, then they're seeing it through the right lens and they're not seeing it from my point of view. They're seeing it from the point of view that's going to be on the TV. So,
and you must find that too. Like, and you said you started to do acting stuff, and but with music as well. Like, don't you find that? I find that if I've written something and I'm in it as well, and I've got someone working with me, a director or someone giving me notes or whatever, or a producer, that if it's someone that I trust and I feel like we've got, I hate shared vision because it sounds a bit like interior designers.
It's true, because again, it is, if you trust them, then you know that they're not just going to be
each other's backs,
just patting you on the back and going, yeah, it's wonderful, is it? It's wonderful,
they
it's
know
perfect.
What you, so, yeah, they want, you want them to push you where they feel it's necessary, but you also want you to be able to trust them to have an eye on things that you can't if you're kind of inside it.
Yeah.
I think it's quite rare to find people. For me, I've only really got a few people who I feel like that about. Yeah. And I hope that as time goes on, I'll get more of a kind of handful of people where I think you just know when you...
It kind of comes back, I think, to highlighting how I think you've got, intentionally or otherwise, a really good balance on things, in that there will be stuff that you'll want to work on alone and you'll want your own vision, do you know what I mean, and not have that clouded other input. But then there's also so many things that you'll work on that are by committee or are with that specific person who can help you or guide you in that way.
Yeah.
And then it gives you confidence in both. If you're doing something without that help, you've got that confidence because you've been doing other stuff that...
I think you're right. I think if you've got more than one project at a time, it's good, because I think you shouldn't really have loads and loads so you don't have time to give to individual things. But when I was auditioning for drama scores, I remember my mum saying, don't wait for the... Because statistically, you're unlikely to get into drama school because the competition is so fierce. So she was like, basically, don't wait for the rejection letter from school A, apply to school B and get working on that audition before, so that if you do get that letter saying no, thank you, you can focus on the next one rather than dwelling on, because again, it's like you know, you can't control that. You can only control what you do when you go in.
100%. And as you said there, when that rejection comes in, you're not sitting there are waiting for it, you're already prepared for what your reaction is. It's not kind of, oh damn, now I've got nothing, you know.
You're focused forward. I think it's so important to be creatively focused on the next thing. So I think what I'd like to do more now is write on my own. I know I've written my radio show on my own and stand up and stuff, and
award-winning radio show on your own.
There it is, there's the old
amazing Sony.
A bit dusty.
That's good.
I think all stand-ups are normally working on like a telly idea. And I think what I've done in the past sometimes is gone, I've got to write a telly idea with someone else. I don't have a clue how to structure an episode of a sitcom. Whereas actually now I think I'd like to have a go. I'm writing something at the moment, a pilot, and I'm going to write it on my own because I think if I write it on my own, it might be better than I think it's going to be. And then I can get someone to give me script notes, as opposed to sitting down with someone I don't know very well, or maybe have never even met properly, and going, should we write a sitcom about people who maybe live in a big house together?
Who could be there for the same reason as you, of thinking, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. I need to sit down with someone else coming. So then it's like, well, now I'm getting advice of someone who doesn't know any better than me. They thought I'd be just as good if I was doing it on my own, you know.
And sometimes two people can be great, but for whatever reason, it doesn't quite gel. Yeah. So individually, so I think that's my plan next, to sort of do stuff where I've been perhaps trying to lean on other people a little bit for the wrong reasons on my own, and then just seeing what happens.
Yeah, it's exciting. We're well over the hour mark, but there's a couple of more things I want to kind of get on. I want to quickly talk about, you mentioned it very briefly earlier. It's beautiful. I've hardly had to look at my notes because it seems, I wanted to talk about that. You mentioned the Edinburgh Fringe briefly earlier. And what kind of excited me is, I think you're one of the first people I've had on who've been there as an actor, who's been there as a stand-up, who's been there in numerous guises and forms. How do you find it in the different ways and in the different forms? Is there one that you found more enjoyable if you're acting in someone else's piece, or if you're performing your own stuff?
Well, I think it depends what you're doing And I think it depends what you need out of it at the time.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I always had a love. So until I started doing shows there,
yeah.
Edinburgh was like the most amazing place on earth to me, Edinburgh Festival. Yeah. I love the city as well. But I mean, during festival time, like,
it's just amazing. Isn't
yeah,
it?
It's incredible. And my dad was Scottish. So I've been up there like every year since.
Yeah.
Since I was about 3 or 4, and I sort of remember going to see this puppet show called Ivan the Slog that was sort of this amazing sort of retelling of biblical stories, but with the main characters a slog and all this mad like dance stuff. And I used to go and see lots of different stuff when I was a kid and when I was a teenager. I didn't really used to go and see that much stand-up till I got to about 20, and still I didn't necessarily know that I'd end up doing stand-up. I would have thought that hopefully I'd go into comedy acting at that point, but or maybe doing this kind of sketch thing, but I didn't really know I'd do stuff on my own.
Yeah.
The first show that I ever did there was called Frog in Love in 2003, and that was a kids show that I'd been doing like around Norwich and stuff, and then it got a run in Edinburgh. So that was quite a nice way of easing into doing Edinburgh, because I was sort of done by like 1 PM, which is pretty early for Edinburgh.
You can go and take things in.
Absolutely.
You're not clashing with anything that you're going to be that hyped about.
Yeah, that's right. Go and watch lots of stuff. And I did a little bit of stand-up up there that year, and then I did a bit more the next year for the Comedy Zone in 2005, which is like a package show. So it seemed like I slowly but surely worked up to doing a full hour. I did like a sort of sketch show come play in 2006 based on the Take a Break magazine that was loads of fun.
Amazing.
I feel like I didn't prematurely do an hour. I think sometimes people feel under that pressure, or they feel under pressure to do like half an hour with someone else. And I think what you don't want
and then
in
to do
Edinburgh,
have to do a new one every year. That's the thing that always blows me away as a musician, where you get to tour the same shitty songs you wrote 10 years ago over and over again. The thought of the Fringe every year, it's like, right, no, that's, and now that's over, that's all dead, and it's on to the next thing. It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard because with your first show tends to be better than your second on the whole, I think, unless you come up with a really outlandish idea for the second, because you've got so much material to choose from the first.
Ideally, first album thing. You spend your whole life writing your first album, and then you've got a year to write your second. You
Completely. Yeah, it was definitely the case with me. Like my 2007 show was loads better than my 2008 one, but I learned a lot from doing the 2008 one. And then I had a break, I was always working over that period, so the decision was made for me, and I was always really relieved if Peep Show Off and filmed in August and I was like, oh my god, I don't have to do Edinburgh, that's so cool,
I've got a reason, and I don't have to explain it to anyone.
No,
I've got a valid
reason.
No one's
going to go, oh, you're lazy, you should be doing,
sorry, have you heard of Peep Show?
No, not any Peep Show, no.
Perfect. Well, let's kind of wrap things up with, obviously your book came out at the beginning of the year, and I believe you're doing a book tour of it at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Number one, how did the book come about, and what's the basis of it? And number two, what are you going to be doing on the book tour? Because I've got a book coming out in August that's based on the podcast, and I can't really tour it because it's all segments from the podcast, unless I do impressions of the guests.
You get a couple of guests per show.
Get some people along and do mini podcast kind of thing. I'm thinking of different ways to do it.
Yeah, but might be good if you dressed up as them.
That'd be great. Yeah. Just try and do everyone's accent. And so
you've
this
done
is
love
a segment.
Already, haven't
I've
you?
Done. I've done love. Yeah. I've got that nailed. Yeah. what was the book and how did it come about?
The book came
about. That must have been a huge. It's we spoke about not wanting to feel grown up. Becoming published feels so grown up in all the right ways.
Yeah,
you know?
I suppose. Yeah, it does. It was good when they delivered. I didn't realise that they'd like deliver a few.
Yeah.
And I opened this box and it was like there, and I was like, oh my god, it's in. There's something quite nice about it being a tangible thing. Yeah. It came about off the back of my radio show, and had a meeting, and we sort of talked about what I would write about if I wrote a book and stuff, and I thought that the most interesting thing for me would be to write about my late 20s, just because I was still kind of going out quite a lot and partying, and was single while a lot of my mates were in relationships, and I'd sort of come out of a serious relationship that I thought perhaps would be like the one. So then that was where the title came from,
the actual one.
It was like, whether there is this sort of one for you. And obviously now I am settled, you know, I'm engaged and I've got a baby, and Ellis is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
But I didn't write about that in the book because I didn't want it to be this sort of, I had this umming and ahhing about it a lot, but I didn't want it to get to the end and be like, So the book kind of became this examination of what it means to be single and why that isn't a bad thing at all and how annoying it is.
It's beautiful that you had to edit real life because you didn't want a sugary happy ending. That's a great thing that
I've got to write a second book, so I was like, maybe I need to hold something back. Nothing interesting happens to me anymore now I've got a baby. I certainly didn't want people to I wanted it to be like a little chat where I was just talking to someone over a beer and kind of spilling my heart out, and I just didn't, when I watch stuff and it feels, you know, like I know the person and it feels quite warm, it always annoys me if at the end they, like when I saw Ben Stiller and a blonde lady, and they play a couple who kind of befriend a couple in their 20s, and they like go out partying with them and stuff.
I can't remember the name of it.
It didn't come out that long ago, but in it, it's really funny.
Yeah.
And Ben Stiller and, I can't remember her name, but she's great. I think she might be called Naomi. Befriend this younger couple. It's a really funny film. It's kind of about when to grow up and like they kind of rediscover their youth and they don't know if they want kids or not. And it's a really, really fantastic film. And then in the very last scene, they've adopted a baby and it feels so unnecessary. I was like, oh no, it feels like you didn't have to do that. It was so American.
And
I loved the film. And then that last bit, I was like, oh, it's so annoying that they felt they had to put that on. Someone must have been a bit like, oh no, we need, you know, I much prefer it when it's just, finishes and you go, yeah, that was like a slice of life.
I think it's great on when creating. Obviously, everyone takes influence from the how they would like their work to be, or something that they're, oh, I'd love to be in that league. But I think it's also great to take inspiration from how you don't want certain things to be, and that's a similar thing there. Although you loved the film,
and I really did, I laughed throughout.
I don't want that. I don't want that happy ending. Really, I don't want that unnecessary ending because it's not real. You know.
Yeah, it just felt like. Yeah, it just felt like you kind of invested in these characters, and then it was like, I don't believe that bit. Yeah. Whereas Victoria isn't like that. She does not adopt a baby at the end.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, you've got to see that.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah, she doesn't. I only watch films where people adopt babies at the end, thank you. I really enjoyed writing it as well. I was like, I didn't know if I would feel kind of a bit flummoxed by how long it had to be and everything, but I really, really got into it.
Did you have any specific techniques or approaches? Because again, it's something that people are often scared to sit down and write a book, because it's like, I don't know how to. Or was it just a case of, right, well, how you write a book is you sit down and you write a fucking book.
Yeah, don't just start it. I also had to write like 5,000 words for them to show them what it would be like, and that was really helpful. So I sort of had these. So when I started off, I had a chunk that wasn't the beginning. So I think the hardest thing is starting it.
It was quite
nice to have a bit of like meat for the middle bit.
Yeah.
And then my system was, I used to get up and not look at my phone, or ideally not talk to anyone, and just like make a coffee and some like cereal or whatever, and then just sit at the computer. And I'd normally write 2,000 words and then that'd be it. So I was normally done by sort of midday.
That's great. It's similar. When we had Danny Wallace on, he had a similar thing of saying, setting himself a daily 2,000 word goal. And the way he did it was he'd have four squares, and he got to cross one out each time. He'd do 500, and maybe once he's crossed out two, he'll have some lunch or have a little break.
Yeah, that's great.
And come back and things like that, which were just so simple and such achievable targets as well, because 2,000 isn't an insane amount. And yeah, it's weird. As soon as anyone says these things, it sounds so easy and so obvious. But often it could be hearing that that makes you go, "All right, yeah, I can possibly achieve that."
Yeah.
So how was it when you completed it and got to hand it in and got to go?
It was good, but it never felt like there was never like a seminal moment where I handed it in, because I was handing in the first draft. Then I had Betty. So in the middle, then I had a meeting. With the editor, and then we sort of talked about, and we made quite a few changes to the structure of it and stuff. So I thought, oh God, I've got quite a lot of work to do. So then I started tentatively
to not have that clear end as well.
No, it didn't. It never felt I suppose at the launch it felt like it was finished, like I really couldn't change anything then unless I went into each book with Biro. And
someone brings a book up to be signed, they go, oh, thank you, just give me 10 minutes, just need to change.
Yeah, there's a bit, I really, God, it's really grating on me about the way I worded my feelings. When I,
switch this.
Yeah, but yeah, I suppose when I... And then when I made it, even when I did the audiobook, me and the producer were still like, oh shit, that's wrong. And so I was emailing her, the editor, every day and being like, is it too late to change it?
Sort of
like
a week
before we went to print or something. But yeah, I think when I got it, I felt like this is done. Yeah.
So what's the plan with the book tour? Because obviously you've toured in, as comedians have a tendency to tour relentlessly and insanely. So is it kind of a sensible run, and what you're going to be doing on the tour?
Well, I've done some of the tour shows sort of a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. I did like a handful of them, and it's going to be quite nice to go back to it in autumn.
It's in September, isn't it?
I might be doing some dates in London in August as well. So I'll put it all on my website. But I think it's hopefully a good mix of there's some readings in it, but what I've done is I've changed a lot of the stuff that I was reading into more stand-up-y stuff so that I'd still do the same material but tell it rather than read it. Because what I was finding at early gigs was it was a bit like, this feels a bit too much like a book reading type event, and I'm doing gigs in like art centres and stuff where it doesn't feel quite right for me to be doing. So then, I sort of tweaked it a bit so it feels hopefully just like a chat with me, where there's a few songs in the sheet music in the book. Just a few songs because I sort of talk about how I used to write songs when I was little and stuff, and I put those in. So I put those into the live show, and then, I really like doing it. It feels like a more easy show to perform than, like, say, Pearl and Dave, my last hour show, because that was a long form story where I played all the different characters and it was much more scripted. I couldn't improvise at all once I'd started, and it was hard if latecomers came in, because I always had this quandary about whether to sort of come out of the story and be like, this is what's happened. I sometimes did and then thought, felt much more delicate and just a different show. Whereas this just feels quite not casual, but chilled, just like a kind of chat.
It's completely unhelpful and irrelevant, but it made me think, I saw a Rob Alton at the Edinburgh Fringe once, and I love Rob Alton.
He's absolutely amazing.
And he had someone come in, and it fits his style perfectly, but he had someone come in mid-set and just come in and look a bit and walk out again, and he just paused and then just went to the audience, did you all see that? I just wanted to check that was actually there.
Just
a real confusion if that was an actual person. And it's just a beautiful moment of dealing with that. But again, that's so much harder if you're telling a story.
Yeah.
Because it's coming out of the characters and coming out of the...
Yeah.
And it feels harsh if you tick that box thing at a theatre where it says that latecomers can't be admitted and stuff like that.
I did do that in Edinburgh, though. I said they couldn't come in after... Because I used to chat a bit.
It's horrible to do, but it's right.
I ticked it, and then I was like, I'm going to forget I ever ticked that.
That wasn't me. That was another me. So where can people keep up to date on everything that is Izzy Sutty?
I've got a website called izzysutty.com. I'm a bit of a Luddite with technology, so I think it's just got all my tour dates on it.
Yep.
But that is the place to go. And I'd love people to come and see me live. And then I've got Twitter. I don't do it myself anymore because I was just getting a bit like, nah, Twitter. It just felt a bit... So at the moment, my PR lady, who's lovely, runs it for me.
That's great.
But I talk to them a lot about what I'm doing, and they tweet about what I'm doing.
And again, that's perfect. There's all of these... social medias, again, it's flexible, and it's using it in the way you choose
sort of in a few months be like, oh, I'll go back on it, but I just needed a bit of a break.
At the moment, it's the perfect place to just get updates on what you're doing. People have a weird, particularly with comedians, there's a strange pressure, and I know Adam Buxton, when he first joined, he felt really uncomfortable with this, was there was a pressure to be funny every day, to give someone some material every day. But it doesn't have to be that. It could be a point where it's just, oh, I've not spoken in a week or two. Here's some important stuff that's happening. You're up to date now.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's easier to follow than someone who's filling your timeline up every day with nonsense. Yeah. So, well, that's perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on and chatting. And
it's a pleasure.
Again, particularly at the end of the podcast, I recommend everyone goes and checks out Things We Do For Love. And I'm looking forward to hearing
hearing more that comes there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobish Picks Discretion Pieces.
How bloody lovely is Izzy Sooty. It was wonderful to get welcomed into her house and just to hear, and again, inspirational to hear her work ethic, her work approach, her ability to balance things from career and family and all sorts of other things. So yeah, that was a lovely one and lovely to chat. So delighted to get in there. That sounds like get in there. Delighted to be welcomed into her house by her and her man and have a good chat. Next week's podcast I'm really excited about. And it's a wrestler, and some people aren't into wrestling. And often you'd think, oh, I'm not into wrestling, so I won't listen. But this is one I really recommend you listen to because it's an amazing story. It's a young man called Will Ospreay, who, if you're into wrestling, you'll probably know he's hyped to be one of the best of all time. He's 23 and he's already achieved huge amounts. He's doing things that no one's ever done in the wrestling ring. He's absolutely amazing. I've seen him live twice and I've watched a load of tape of him and it's just mind-blowing. But what's absolutely fascinating is he's a 23-year-old kid from Essex whose parents supported him in his wrestling, and I won't give any spoilers, but did certain things to really help out his career and development. His dad takes him to every show and all this kind of thing and has been hugely supportive. But the thing that really excites me is he's holding down a day job on building sites. And it's crazy because a few weeks ago, he had his debut at New Japan Wrestling, which is one of the biggest organizations in the world. You'd probably say there's WWE and then there's a New Japan Pro Wrestling. He had his debut there. He signed a big contract with them. They're hugely excited about him. He's going to be a massive star. And again, just bear in mind, a New Japan is where so many people have gone from New Japan to WWE and become huge stars. So he had his debut in New Japan and wrestled an emotional match in the podcast. In fact, there are tears. It gets emotional. There's reasons that it's a very, it was an intense podcast to be part of, but he wrestles in front of 11,000 people. And then a few days later, he's back in Essex on a building site, putting down mastic, sealing windows and showers and whatnot. It's amazing. It's a hell of a story, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So I highly recommend you tune in next week for episode 98 with Will Ospreay. I love doing this podcast and it not just being about who's most famous. What big famous names can we get on here? I mean, there's a part of me as well. I'm genuinely convinced that Will is going to at some point be the best in the world. So it's good for me to have a podcast with him at the age of 23 talking about all that's ahead and the early stages, I guess, of his career. So I'm not going to lie, there's a selfishness there as well. But I like the fact that we have people you don't have to have heard of these people. You don't have to be knowledgeable of their industry or their work to enjoy the podcast and the interview. So yeah, that is that. I'm going to stop now and let you all go. Thank you all for tuning in. If you could rate and review us on iTunes, that genuinely makes a difference. I know every podcast says that at the end and you just ignore it because that's what happens. I'd do it. But if you could actually just, you've ignored it. Now I'm going to repeat it. And if you could just go, all right, well, quickly, I'll just open it up on the iTunes. And if you're listening on iTunes, I'll rate it. I mean, and my lucky number happens to be 5. So if you want to give a 5-star review, then that's just swell. But it all helps in the charts and in pushing us out there. And it helps us get sponsors that push it out there as well and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, thank you very much for tuning in. I'll be back next week with episode 98. We're getting close to that 100 mark. Hot damn. Yeah, I'm going to stop talking now. See you in a bit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.